Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to The Mentor, I'm Mike Boris. As a society, we rely too heavily on the linear economy. Yep, that's right. It's called the linear economy. That is take, make, use, dispose. It's really inefficient. You know, the idea that raw materials are collected, then transformed into products that are used until they are discarded as waste makes no sense. Doesn't make sense for the planet and it doesn't make sense for business. It's just inefficient. But you have heard of the circular economy, haven't you? Maybe you haven't. Emphasize the word circular. That is creating products that are reusable and fixable. So designing out waste. Gumtree and Planet Ark have teamed up to help Aussie consumers join the circular economy. This is why I brought on Nicole Garofano. She is the head of circular economy development at Planet Ark. She is passionate about creating change in how we generate and manage resources. Nicole and I chat about why is the circular economy good for business? How can you make this part of your business? Because I think this is the future. How do you build products and design products that are going to be able to sell into the circular economy for the future? If you're a consumer, how do you make demands for vendors to supply circular economy style products, things that are reusable at another date? This is a really great discussion. It's important. It's the future. So let's get into it. Nicole Garofano, welcome to The Mentor.
Thank you so much, Mark. It's such a privilege and a pleasure to be here with you.
You and I met more recently with the joint venture that Planet Ark has been doing or is doing with Gumtree, and which I find fascinating. And I'm an ambassador for that joint venture and for Gumtree. What I find fascinating is actually the joint venture of, you know, these two groups. They're particularly different, but it's a pretty unusual place for me anyway. Like, I'm a full-on hard-nosed capitalist to be talking to someone from Planet Ark, and it's a different place. You know, like, well, for me, my perception has been it's a different place. And but recently my perception has changed. But what I would like to understand is where'd you start from and how'd you end up in this role at Planet Ark? Because it's sort of a big leap.
Yeah, I've got an interesting story. My background is actually, my first career was in the travel industry. So I spent 14 years based in Sydney. I had always wanted to work in travel ever since I was a teenager. But in 2003, I had the opportunity to take a year off, and I spent 7 months traveling through Central and South America, backpacking and just experiencing the world. I'd done travel before that because of my career, of course, but never on my own and in a backpacking type of mode. So met some amazing people, had some incredible experiences. But then I ended up in Barbados. After that 7 months, I traveled to the small island state of Barbados. I ended up spending 3 months there. The first month I enjoyed what you do on a Caribbean island, lots of sun, lots of beaches, lots of evenings out, but I felt like after that first month I needed to do something more. And so after that first month, I found myself volunteering with an organization that did environmental education. And I'd never done anything like this before. I'd been introduced to this organization from a woman I met in Brazil several months earlier. So I went there actually to say hello to the person that she knew when she was there, and that person no longer worked at the center. But I asked the question, so what do you do here? And I was, you know, they shared what they did. They had school children coming through. They had a garden. I thought this was interesting. And I said, well, do you need some help? And it was those two questions that have led me to be speaking with you here today, because if I hadn't have gone to that center, I wouldn't have been introduced to environmental education. I wouldn't have been introduced to the challenges that sit within small island developing states around environment, and I wouldn't have taken the path that I've taken to get here today representing Planet Ark.
So are you saying that you never really thought too much about the environment
How does that connect? I know it's a disconnect. It wasn't something that was front of mind. Growing up in Australia, you know, we are blessed with a beautiful country, and I grew up with Keep Australia Beautiful, and all of those things. You know, we grew up with recycling, but it wasn't on my list of passions. It wasn't something that I saw myself working in. I think that year that I took off and found myself in amazing, you know, such diverse environments, you know, going to the salt plains in Bolivia, going to the Amazon, having the pleasure of sitting in Machu Picchu, going right down to Ushuaia, where all the boats go off to Antarctica. Such incredible diverse environments. And I really think that plus the people I was meeting along the way and being immersed in this extremely historical range of cultures, it really just opened my eyes up to things that I hadn't really thought of before.
I don't really know too many people who have done that. I'm guessing you weren't like 19 or 20 when you took your year off. I get it that someone says, okay, I'm going to go to South America. Got it. But then all of a sudden you start doing all this quite unusual moves. You know? Can I ask you something? I mean, I choose not to answer this, but like it's just a feeling I have. When people do something like this after being at a travel agency for a number of years and assuming the travel agency wasn't going to go broke, sometimes people are either bored shitless in their life and they decide to take these 7-month periods off, or something's happened in their personal life, they're running away from it, or they're running to something.
Yeah, look, I think it was a combination. I had always wanted to take a year off and go and work somewhere else in the world for 2 years. I'd always wanted to do that since I was a teenager. The circumstances arose that, yes, there was a significant event in my life that provided me with both the time and the finances to be able to take this journey. You know, I had a business at the time. At the end of that 14 years, I'd developed a consulting small business that I was supporting travel agency owners. But it was a case of, if I don't do this now, it's not going to happen. You know, there were many times I was reflecting on this over the weekend, actually, that I was just thought to myself, what am I doing? I should go home. This is ridiculous. You know, I'm at this point in my life where I should be doing other things. But, you know, reverse charge calls, as they were back in the day, I had some beautiful friends and wonderful family on the end of those calls saying, look, you can come home anytime. That's absolutely sure. You can come home anytime. But why not just keep going for a bit longer and see how you go? And those words were just invaluable, because I did keep pushing myself and I did keep just on the road. I guess it was just, I don't know, curiosity, interest, resilience, meeting wonderful people and just wanting to explore.
Is there a common culture that you found that was particularly enriching that sort of kept you there in a gravity sense?
There's a really strong sense of community in those cultures, which I feel like we still have a sense of community, and I think probably COVID has kind of revealed some of that. But I feel like we're quite a bit more disjointed than what communities in Central and South America have. There's more of a connection. And I think the other thing is that the communities that I was working with, particularly not working with, traveling around, is they have a deep connection to the environment. And I don't think I realized that until much later. The way that the crops are planted, they have a very strong appreciation of, you know, working with the planetary movements when it comes to agriculture. So there's just a really strong appreciation of what the environment can offer.
Yeah, that's interesting, that, because I think we're disconnected here in the cities for sure. Pretty much everything you want is available all year round. You can get our oranges in the middle of summer.
Yeah.
And you don't have appreciation of seasons. Like, one of the things I always found fascinating is that my father's an old Greek fella, and, you know, we're pretty connected. And I was at his place. He lives in Sydney, but it was time to plant garlic. And he reminded me the best time to plant garlic is on the winter solstice. You should plant it on the 21st of June or thereabouts, and harvest it on the 20-odd of December, the summer solstice. You know, and it's a global thing. You plant garlic on the shortest day of the year, for whatever the reason is. I'm sure this has been something that's been going for thousands of years, but it's something I would never have heard of. I'm not likely to come across that, you know, unless I go and talk to my father or, like you, travel. So these things have a big influence on us.
Yeah. Just to sort of finish off that Barbados story, after those 2 months of volunteering, I left and got the call from the, or an email from the chairman to ask if I would come back for a 2-year contract. And so at the time I sort of tossed up whether I continue with working. I was looking for work in the UK by this stage. It was about 6 weeks after I left Barbados. And I got this opportunity to go back. And I thought, well, you know what? I think I'm going to do that. And so I chose to go back, again, with a few universal interjections to send me that direction. And so I went back for 2 years, but the 2 years ended up being 8 years.
Wow.
The organization that I volunteered with for those couple of months, I ended up running it by the time I had left. So those 8 years were really instrumental in deciding on what were the next steps. And so leaving Barbados in 2012, I first chose to do a master's degree, and that was in development practice with a focus on environmental management as sort of a secondary topic.
Were you back in Australia?
Yes. Yeah. I came back to Australia to do that. And so once I'd finished the master's, I had a very different perspective on the concept of colonialism. You know, I don't remember that from school, but certainly the impact of, you know, colonialism on global trade, you know, sort of ownership, if you will, of countries like Barbados, where I was living for all those years. It really provided the theoretical lens that I was able to review my experiences in a very different way. I came out of that thinking, okay, well, now I've got this theoretical lens. I've got all these years of experience in Barbados. I want to do something more. And so the next thing that I did was actually to design my own research program, which was to take an assessment that I did in my master's, which was design a survey. I chose to design a sort of a mock survey on some of the programs that I implemented in Barbados. And I decided that I would take that survey and actually go back to Barbados, find some funding. So I got my own funding to go back and complete this research project. And it was from that experience that a very kind academic, wasn't a formal supervisor, but she agreed to guide me on that private research project. She said, "Nicole, why aren't you doing this as a PhD again? Remind me." And so she was the one who actually encouraged me to consider that I was clever enough. The focus of the PhD was plastic food and beverage packaging material. And I was interested in mapping the value chain of those materials going into and how they work their way through small island developing states. So I took the previous sort of 10 years or 12 years of experience that I had generated, and through those experiences recognized the challenges that exist in small island developing states, particularly around waste, and applied that to, I guess, understand what small island developing states could actually do to change the value chain that they are participating in, and whether or not there could be innovations that could be adopted both from the point of manufacturer or brand owner all the way through the chain to small island state, the consumers, you know, in the shopping centre, in the supermarkets, buying their products, and then what happens to it post-consumption. So the end result is some recommendations for policymakers in small island developing states, but also for brand owners to reconsider their product choices for all markets, not just their most populous markets.
I think as business owners, and it doesn't affect my business as such because, you know, we sell money effectively, so there's no packaging at all. But nonetheless, I think there's a lot of structural change occurring in the world and in global economies. I think in order to survive, take advantage of opportunities that might be going to present themselves in the future. Therefore, as a business owner, you need to think about these things for the future, about future-proofing your business. You need to think about these concepts as opposed to just saying, which probably I was guilty of and one of the people in that category, oh, that's just quirky. You know, like I'll just keep doing what I'm doing. I don't know whether I'm because I'm getting old or what. I'm just becoming much more aware of, you know, waste, much more aware of waste. Like in everything I do, everything I acquire, everything I buy, I get so aggravated when I see loads and loads of plastic, which is like thick, and I got to carve through it to get it open, and like, and I just see, well, why are they doing this? So, to some extent, I think what people like Nicole are doing is more a reflection of how society is changing.
Yeah, I would agree, Mark. Nothing, you know, the point of doing a PhD is you need to contribute something novel to what exists already, and I certainly did that. But the thing is that the novelty of my research, and certainly probably many other PhDs, is built on the experiences of academic research that has come before or industry research that has come before. The social change in how we consume, particularly in the last sort of 70 years, I guess, since like the 1950s, is a phenomenal shift. And that has been driven predominantly by convenience. It's been driven by women entering the workforce, global trade. There are so many factors as to why I even, you know, chose that topic. Why is plastic even a consideration in small island developing states? It's because the world, the social world, the economic world has changed. Now that we're recognizing that, though, this is where the shifts are starting to occur. And I feel like that's where the excitement is. You know, it's about recognizing that what has been done hasn't all been good. We need to start recognizing where those innovations, those shifts can happen, not just because we want to turn over more money, but because there's actually a finite limit to the way that we're operating.
I mean, I think that takes us right into the whole concept of economies and the concept of what a linear economy is. Not old school yet, but it's sort of, it is old school, if you know what I mean. It's evolving into something else. But I think our starting point's got to be, what is the linear economy?
So the linear economy is how we've always done things, essentially. If you've ever heard the words take, make, waste, we take resources from the planet, we make products from those resources, which we just put on shelves. We then use the products and then we waste them. So it's take, make, use, dispose in a very straight line without any consideration of what sort of environmental impacts are being made. It's something that has been like that since the Industrial Revolution. We extract around 100 billion tons of material from the earth each year, and we only recover less than 10% of that to send back into the economy. So it's a very, very straight-lined approach from digging a hole in the ground to putting stuff back in a hole in the ground at the end of life.
And what you put back is not what you took out either. I see it as extraordinarily inefficient because we're taking out more than we need to take out. We are wasting a whole lot at the end of the chain. Therefore, we're extracting more than we need to, and we're wasting more than we need to because we're not thinking about how the bit in the middle, we're not working out how to make it sustainable. We're just making it transactional. Yeah. And business and economics are all about efficiencies. And what's amazing for me is that we haven't, we're so advanced and so sophisticated in the way we think, and our technology is so good, and, you know, et cetera. We can fly to the moon, what have you. And yet we're not very sophisticated in our thinking of how we can become more efficient.
Part of the reason why it is inefficient is because we price the extraction of materials. So mining obviously is a massive industry. We put heavy prices on that. There's heaps of processing that goes into mining to take it from something that's dug out of the ground into our phones, for example, with electronics. There's a great focus on that end of the spectrum, but the inefficiencies occur all the way along, particularly at end of life. If aluminium cans, for example, are not recycled, all those inputs that have been invested from the point of just actually digging the bauxite out of the ground all the way to that can being sent into a landfill has just been wasted. And I also find it interesting that we put so much focus on extracting, on mining raw materials, but yet mining materials post-consumption doesn't attract the same level of attention and investment. Why not? You know, they're still valuable materials. You've got gold, you've got precious metals that sit in particularly electronics. Why aren't we considering that if we've got such an inefficient process to get from extraction to post-use? Why can't we invest in that post-use environment?
It's a good question. And I think more economists and more engineers or designers, electrical engineers, mechanical engineers, the people who get involved in the design process of a product, I don't want to greenwash it, okay? I'm just not interested in greenwashing this. Because people won't believe me for a start, but so I'm not. But as an economic hardline economic person, I just see the inefficiencies of this are so stark that it's insurmountable. You cannot not get over the inefficiencies. Like we've got to do something about it. And by the way, we clean the joint up as well. How did you get to Planet Ark?
I've only been with Planet Ark since May, so three and a bit months. But my journey to here, I feel, is the result of really sort of the last 16 years. Being able to observe and participate in an economy that was quite challenged for, you know, everything was imported. So living in Barbados for those 8 years, the country predominantly exists on imported products. So I started to become much more aware of the impact that made for both local manufacturing to jobs, recognizing that physically there's not enough land space to provide for all of the materials that are needed in a modern, convenient lifestyle. And so that started the journey of asking these questions. But my experience of that environmental education was the overarching theme while I was in Barbados. So essentially what we were doing there is a very sort of smaller version, I guess, of what Planet Ark does on a much bigger scale in Australia. So there were some similarities there. But beyond that, I've also worked in waste management as a consultant in other countries, in Bangladesh, in Vanuatu. I've also worked in tourism, sustainable tourism, in my later life. So that combined suite of knowledge, and particularly understanding the value chain as I have done with my PhD, I understand the challenges of trying to transition to a circular economy and where the opportunities might be to interject with a circular economy in Australia. So, for example, the challenges that I found in my PhD were broadly around scale and logistics. So economies of scale are very, very small in island states, and particularly when you've got archipelagos, you've got people that are living in quite remote areas. And logistics, so trying to get products in, trying to get products around, and post-consumption, how to get potential resources, waste material or secondary materials, back into a hub where you can build scale. These were two really important elements. When I finished the PhD and I reflected on the journey that I had just undertaken, I started to realize that I saw where the circular economy is most challenged. And then I started to realize, well, this happens in Australia. We've got rural and remote areas in Australia that have small scale, that have logistics challenges. There were opportunities to interject to improve the circular economy here in Australia. And I saw this role at Planet Ark and I thought, yeah, that aligns with where I'm going. You know, I've realized that my purpose in life, my why, following on from your experiences as well, Mark, is to create change in how we generate and manage resources. And so I was looking for an organization that could align with my life purpose. And the Planet Ark offer was that.
And what we're talking about here is a circular economy, which is the evolved economy from where we started off, what we talked about earlier, the linear economy. So it's the next version, linear economy iteration number 20. Yeah, whatever. It's a long, long way from where the linear economy is. Yeah. But nonetheless, it is part of the evolution. It's not like we hate the linear economy. I think what we all got to do is recognize there isn't a linear economy and it probably exists in some places. But now we're sophisticated enough to actually go to the circular economy, and the circular economy is a new economy, which makes a lot more sense. And when I come back from the break, I actually want you to really break down what the circular economy is. You and I sort of understand it. You much more than I. And especially in terms of, Nicole, what they should be thinking of in terms of their own businesses and future-proofing their businesses. That's really important. So we'll go to the break and we'll come straight back. Now I'm here with Nicole Garofano. Like, what is a circular economy?
So a circular economy is something that transforms that linear economy that we were talking about earlier. It is much more resource-oriented. It's not just about putting products on the market. It's actually about designing products that can actually move throughout a circle and come back in. So it is about identifying where we can move away from designing products just to put onto a shelf to designing products that could potentially be deconstructed, that could be reused, that could be recycled if they need to be, and have those materials in that product holding their value at the highest possible level. So essentially keeping products in use for longer. There's three principles that underpin the circular economy. And the first one is what you were speaking about earlier, which is designing out waste and pollution. So this is where designers, engineers, people that are making decisions about what a brand looks like on a shelf or what products to put on the market, they can play a really pivotal role in how we can have products that can come back into the economy, either in as a whole in a reuse model, or to be used in as the sum of its parts, either through deconstruction or through recycling. So principle one is really important, designing out waste and pollution. Principle number two is keeping those materials in use for longer and at their highest value. That's really what we kind of look at where recycling kind of fits in, where if we produce packaging, for example, often people would consider putting the packaging in the yellow top bin for recycling. And so that is a lower ranked option, if you like. Recycling is one of the last options that we could consider. But if we can consider keeping materials like what happens on Gumtree, reusing products in use for longer, that's principle two. And then the third principle is about regenerating natural systems. And so in the course of designing products, we should be considering the natural systems that enable us to put those products on the shelf. So if we can consider our water consumption in the design of products and how they're managed at end of life, if we can use renewable energy to make those products, if we can consider agricultural crops to be using less hazardous chemicals in their production, that's all about regenerating natural systems. So these are sort of the three core principles that underpin the circular economy.
How hard is it to change the status quo? Because like the status quo largely is controlled by mining giants who don't like retooling their business. Or if we're talking about plastic manufacturers who have incredible political influence, and I know some, for example, here right here in Australia, who actually work on their political influence. And it's an easy thing to do working on political influence. You just make sure you support the party that's going to win the election, and you the best way to support them is through, you know, financial ways. How hard is it for you to move the dial? Because right now, you know, we've got plastic, as you said, yellow bins, but that's the lowest common denominator. You know, we all think we're being environmentally responsible because we put our plastic and cardboard into the, you know, the yellow lid. But that's really the smallest contribution we can make. How hard is it to turn the dial properly? What are the friction points?
Well, I think consumers are actually turning the dial for us. As much as we feel that our one purchase decision doesn't make a difference. When you've got, you know, 7.8 billion people on the planet, obviously we're at different levels of development. But when you have a significant number of people calling out unsustainable practices of businesses, that can drive significant change with very significant brand owners. One small example is a major soft drink brand that has changed the color of their soft drinks from green to clear, because consumers were calling out that green plastic is not as easily recyclable as clear plastic. And so with consumers becoming much more aware of supply chains and what products are being put out into the market, that's just one small example of how major brands are actually rethinking their products and rethinking how they present themselves to the market.
But Nicole, is it like getting trolled on Twitter and like, I mean, how does that consumer movement make this organization change from green plastic bottles to clear plastic bottle? Do they have to be embarrassed into it, or at their management level, do they sit down themselves and start to say, you know what, wouldn't it be a good idea to get rid of green bottles and do clear bottles? Where does it start and end?
I don't work for them, so I'm only making assumptions from the outside in. But I would say it's more from the pressure that is being applied from the market. Consumers have a very strong voice, and those consumers, social media has certainly changed how we interact with our brands and with our product owners. Things like the Blue Planet Effect, which is actually a term that was coined from Sir David Attenborough's BBC Blue Planet show, puts a spotlight on the impacts to our environment from particularly plastic ending up in marine environments particularly. And so this combined attention that has been placed on products is really shifting the bar. Yes, there are some who are not necessarily making those shifts, but when they're not, their consumers are calling them out on it. And it's really exciting to see. All of a sudden, it seems like the tide is turning, you know, from going back to the 1950s when plastic became commercially viable. And it was sold as the housewife's solution to having to be behind the kitchen sink washing up all the dishes every night. You know, just use a disposable plate. I remember the seeing a cover of an American magazine that showed a 1950s woman now being able to use plastic plates and just throw them in the bin rather than having to stand behind the kitchen sink. And so this was storytelling driven by the market, that they wanted to put their products on the market. Well, now it's storytelling driven by the consumer because they want to see a change in how they're consuming.
And what's Planet Ark's role then? How do they see themselves?
So particularly in the case of the circular economy, we see ourselves as facilitating the transition to a circular economy. So Planet Ark's been around for almost 30 years next year. And for much of that time, we have been focused on providing or encouraging the public to get involved in activities that reduce their environmental footprint. And so those have been, you know, we have Recycling Near You is our website platform that helps people understand where they can recycle. We have National Recycling Week. We've had a number of product stewardship schemes over the years. We've mostly been dealing with the public in order to create that change. What we recognise with the circular economy is that, like the market has shifted, we are also shifting to be engaging much more with industry, with private sector, but also with levels of government, so local governments particularly, because they are procuring products on a daily basis, particularly governments are the largest consumers in the country. And so it's working with industry to support them in making those design choices around what products they're putting on the market, working with end-of-life processes to look at how we can support them to bring their stories to the table, you know, to reveal their challenges but also see the opportunities. And so it's much more of a shift for Planet Ark to still supporting and educating the consumer, certainly through our Gumtree partnership, you know, our reuse platform. Reuse is a really core part of the circular economy. But it's more around how can we make that shift at the front end rather than waiting until we get to that end of life decision, post-consumption, yellow bin scenario.
Are you finding, though, that, say, for example, better design when it comes to the circular economy, other organisations approaching you, or do you still have to push your way in there?
At the moment, it's a mix of both. Australia's really relatively new in this circular economy discussion. So I feel like the organisations who are coming to us are seeing what's happening overseas, so particularly in Europe, where the circular economy is really gaining traction. They've been working on this for most of the decade, I would say. And so those organisations with footprints in Europe, where Australia might be a regional office, those folks are finding their way through. But the ones that are more Australian grown, if you like, we're sort of going to them more so, I would say.
Do they open the door? Are they happy to see you, or...?
I mean, well, yes.
Are you experiencing friction? Like,
there's a sense for some organisations that, you know, this is just another thing. We don't have to worry about this. We'll just carry on business as usual. But I do feel like the pressure of realising, again, that global pressure, that societal pressure, is at least having them have the conversation. It's not just closing the door straight in the face to say, no, I'm not interested. I think there is more... just start to rethink supply chains. And I think COVID has actually helped that, because the risk to supply chain has just been phenomenal in the last 18 months, particularly in that first 6 months where products just weren't being traded. Products just couldn't get out. Global trade didn't come to a halt, but it was severely impacted. And I feel like that has raised the profile of potential risk. And that is where, if you're considering your business from a circular economy perspective, that you're actually really allowing time, which I know is very difficult for small business owners particularly, but you're really allowing time to look at where are the risk points in my supply chain. And if you only do it because of risk, let's look at where you can design products to have an extended life, potentially provide a service, a repair service as part of your offering, for example. Look at where you could replace imported products to locally supplied products. I know that there's always a cost consideration, but it's having those conversations to start to think. And I think that's the promising part for us, that most organisations are at least willing to have that conversation.
And one of the notions that I thought was quite appealing, as opposed to, like, as I said, and greenwashing this process and trying to appear as an environmentally aware person which, by the way, I am environmentally aware, but yeah, I'm very careful not to try and pitch myself as somebody like that, because that's greenwashing, and so many people are doing it, like, it's nauseating, to be honest with you. One of the things that I found very appealing, the notion I found very appealing in relation to the circular economy, and as you say, it's been going on overseas for a long time, is that one thing we should all aspire to is to pick a proxy that's close to perfection in terms of how an economy works. And the most obvious one is, to me, is nature. Mm-hmm. You know, like an animal's born, eats the grass, and animal dies and it sort of disintegrates into the soil and produces nitrogen, and the grass regrows and the carbon from the animal goes back into the soil, etc. That's a perfect circular economy.
Yeah.
And that makes sense. And that's not greenwashing. That's not environmental anything. It's just smart.
It's factual. That's what happens. Yeah, in nature there's no such thing as waste.
Mm. And it's very, very clever. It's a very clever analogy that you raise. And and I think the more awareness of that, to me, would be really good. And I think the next one is the economic effects. Like, if consumers start to demand a product differently designed, more sustainably designed, however sustainable, it could be a number of reasons, reusable parts, less plastic, whatever it is, then the producers of the products, they're going to have to get their act together, otherwise they're going to lose market share.
Yes. Yeah.
Do you guys build up these scenarios whereby you can sort of see a new trend in a particular product line that you take to producers of these products and start to say, hey, listen, this is the experience going on in some other place in the world. Consumers are flocking to this type of product. Maybe you need to start to think about re-engineering.
Yeah, I mean, we do have a number of case studies, and we do offer those to anyone who's interested. I mean, it's not something, you know, you can take a horse to water, but you can't make it drink. So we've got lots of resources that those who are interested can learn from. You know, if we look at that consumer model, calling on the Gumtree report that we were launching a couple of months ago, people that they surveyed show that 81% of the Australians who participated in that survey are already willing to change the way that they consume goods to be more environmentally friendly than they were 10 years ago. So 81%, I mean, that's a phenomenal number. People are actually tuning into the stories of products. And I feel like there is the opportunity to learn from the likes of the Netherlands, for example. I would say the Netherlands is probably the global leader when it comes to circular economy. They've had a national circular economy strategy since 2016. Even they admit that they haven't achieved everything that they would like to have achieved. And if we have to go elsewhere to learn, then that's the way we do it. We have to recognise that we can't pick up what's there and just drop it straight into Australia. There are some localisation needs that are required. But it's really about how can we, like my PhD, how can you learn from those that have gone before you and be a first mover in the Australian context? And that's what you really are at this stage, because we're still in that very early phase of transitioning to this circular economy.
And I would say to our small business community who's listening to this, maybe you can't really influence what you put on your shelves. Maybe you can't, because, you know, you're not making enough money to be able to indulge yourself that you can't put on the shelves some things that you just need to sell and make a margin so you can pay your rent, especially at the moment. I get it. But I'd also say to you, keep pace with this. Keep in touch with what we are talking about here, because at some stage there may well be a switch, and you don't want to get caught unawares. You don't want to get caught and say, oh, wow, I never thought about that. And this is about predicting your market, and you've got to understand what the discussion's about. That's why I've asked Nicole to come on today, to give you an understanding of what the discussion is on a global basis, on a huge macro basis, and that over time, for me, the circular economy over time will become the discussion as opposed to linear economy. It will become that way because it's smarter, it makes sense, it's logical in every aspect, not just from an environmental point of view, but from every aspect, efficiencies, and it's just smarter. And I think over time you're going to find the younger kids who are at universities who are coming out as engineers or, you know, industrial designers, mechanical designers, as I said before. And I think we're going to get in the next 10 years graduates who will then be in their, you know, 30s and 40s who have done masters and PhDs who are going to start saying, you know what, when I was at university, I heard Nicole talk about this or I watched something on Planet Ark, and they're going to start designing this in. But nonetheless, if you're in small business and you're trying to build a sustainable business, you've got to get onto this. This is really important. And first and foremost, understand the evolution from the linear economy to the circular economy. I don't know if we've got much more time to go much further into the circular economy, Nicole, but I always give everyone an opportunity because I've been asking all the questions, ask me a question. Not that I probably have much expertise, to be frank with you, in your area, but maybe you've got a question for me.
I actually do have a question, and it's not so much in relation to the circular economy. It's actually just a bit more about your journey. So as I mentioned, in full transparency, I've just finished reading your book, Rise, which has been very interesting and enlightening. It really showed that your guts, your tenacity, your resilience, and also how you've reflected over the years, I thought was really interesting as well for me. And so I'm obviously very grateful to be here and speaking to you and have my journey over the last number of decades. But reflecting on the decision to uproot my life, essentially, you know, those sort of almost 20 years ago, I feel that reflection is such a valuable tool. And I wonder from all the words in your book and from the many words that you've spoken over the years in various fora, if you could go back to your 25-year-old self, what would be the one piece of advice that you would give 25-year-old Mark Burris?
Okay, that's a good question. Relax. Don't be in a hurry. Yeah. Don't be in a hurry. Don't think you're intellectually superior to everybody around you and that you know and understand things better than everybody else because you don't. Don't undermine experience relative to academic learnings. You know, because I grew up in an environment where not that many people had the same academic qualifications I had, but a lot of them had a lot of experience. And I undermined their experience. That's sort of intellectual arrogance. And be much more considerate of everything that is in front of you, everyone that is in front of you. And ultimately, you'll be much more judicious in your decisions. So that's probably what I would say to myself when I was 25. And then I'd say to myself, and if you don't listen to yourself, Mark, give yourself an uppercut because that might be the only thing you get that's going to actually stop you from doing what you're doing. Yeah, when I was 25, I was all those things. But over time, I've thought things through a lot more, and I've seen a lot more ups and downs, plenty of downs, and I've learned how to be more considerate of everything around me, which is, look, I would never considered, but look, at 25, environment was not a thought. And that's 40 years ago, okay, for me. But these things are all now really important to me, and not just in the context of protecting the planet as a term, but more just the overall efficiency of everything we do in our life.
It just makes sense. It
just makes sense to me. And I would never have thought that in the past because I would have gone, no, it's about making a profit and getting things out the door because people want to buy it. I would never have thought of these concepts that I'm thinking about with you. And even like, you know, the home loan business, which is my major undertaking these days, always has been, that was always about making a buck for me as opposed to help people getting people into a home, something they dream about. I mean, and that's more important than making a buck because as soon as you do that, you make a buck. And that's what we talk about, our why, our purpose. That wasn't something I started thinking about until I was 40.
Mm-hmm.
Because I was I approached everything from an academic point of view. What's the algorithm? What are the inputs? And what's the output?
Yeah.
Got to have a margin in there. That's all I ever thought about. That's all very good, but that doesn't achieve anything at the end of the day unless you put someone into a home and you've got to convince them that they should deal with you.
Yeah.
And they're not going to deal with you unless they know you're thinking the way they're thinking, just like what you're doing now. And why I resonated with the partnership between yourselves and Gumtree and why I agreed to do this with Gumtree when they approached me. I mean, Gumtree, I had to think about this, you know, like when Gumtree put it to me because it's not something I would ordinarily do. But I actually believe in this circular economy. I think it's real. I think it makes sense. And it has a whole lot of good outcomes as well. But it just makes sense. It's smart.
Yeah.
And there is an intellect around. I say to everybody who's listening to today, think about what Nicole is talking about, a circular economy being an evolution of the original linear economy, why we are now going into this territory.
Yeah.
Then please engage and talk to other people about it. It's really important. Thanks very much, Nicole. That was awesome.
Thank you so much, Mark. Pleasure to be here.
Thanks for listening to The Mentor. Audio and production is by Jess Morley. And production assistants, Jonathan Leondis.